Chapter 6. "Oh," Temeraire said, in a very strange tone, and he pitched forward and vomited tremendously all over the open ground before him, heaving up an acrid, stinking mess in which the traces of banana leaves, goat horns, coconut shells, and long green ropes of braided seaweed might be distinguished among the generalized yellowish mulch, scattered through with unrecognizable scraps of cracked bones and shreds of hide. "Canes!" Lawrence bellowed, having leapt out of the way just in time, and to the two hapless medicine men who had offered the latest remedy savagely said, "Get you gone, and take that worthless draught with you!"
"No, let us have it, if you please, and the receipt," Canes said, approaching a little gingerly and bending to sniff at the pot which they had presented. "A purgative may be of some use on future occasions, if this is not simply a case of excess. Were you feeling ill before?" Canes demanded of Temeraire, who only moaned a little and closed his eyes. He was lying limp and wretched, having crept a little way off from the former contents of his stomach, which steamed unpleasantly even in the overheated late summer air. Lawrence covered his mouth and nostrils with a handkerchief and beckoned to the deeply reluctant groundsmen to bring the midden shovels and bury the refuse at once. "I wonder if it is not the effects of the protea," Dorset said absently, poking through the pot with a stick and fishing out the remnants of the spiny blossom. "I do not believe we have seen it used as an ingredient before. The Cape vegetation has quite a unique construction among the Planet Kingdom. I must send the children for some specimens."
"As glad as we must be to have delivered you a curiosity, it is certainly nothing which he ever ate before. Perhaps you might consider how we are to proceed instead without making him ill again," Lawrence snapped, and went to Temeraire's side before he could make a further display of his ill temper and frustration. He laid a hand on the slowly heaving muzzle, and Temeraire twitched his ruff in an attempt at bravery.
"Roland, go you and Dyer and fetch some sea water from beneath the dock," Lawrence said, and taking a cloth used the cool water to wipe down Temeraire's muzzle and his jaws.
They had been in Cape Town now 2 days, experimenting lavishly, Temeraire perfectly willing to sniff or swallow anything which anyone should give him, if only it might, by some chance, be a cure, and exercise his memory. So far without any notable success, and Lawrence was prepared to consider this latest episode a notable failure, whatever the surgeons might say. He did not know how to refuse them, but it seemed to him they were trying a great deal of local quackery without any real grounds for hope, and making a reckless trial of Temeraire's health.
"I already feel a good deal better," Temeraire said.
But his eyes were closing in exhaustion as he said it, and he did not want to eat anything the next day, but said wistfully,
"I would be glad of some tea, if it would not be much trouble."
So Gong Su made a great kettle of it, using a week's supply, and then, to his disgust, they put in an entire brick of sugar. Temeraire drank it with great pleasure when it had cooled, and afterwards stoutly declared himself perfectly recovered. But he still looked rather dismally when Emily and Dyer came huffing back from the markets, hung all over with the day's new acquisitions in net, bags, and parcels, and stinking from 10 yards distance.
"Well, let us see," Keynes said, and went poking through the materials with Gong Su.
A great many local vegetables, including a long, pendulous fruit, like an oversized yam which Gong Su dubiously picked up and thumped against the ground, not even the skin so much as split, until he at last took it into the castle, to the smith, and had it smashed open upon the forge.
"That is from a sausage tree," Emily said. "Maybe it is not quite ripe, though. And also we did find some of the hua jiao today from a Malay stallkeeper," she added,
showing Lawrence a small basket of the red peppery seeds, for which Temeraire had acquired a great liking.
"Not the mushroom?" Lawrence asked.
This being a hideously pungent specimen, they all recalled vividly from their first visit, which, in its cooking, had rendered the entire castle nearly uninhabitable from its noxious fumes. Lawrence had his share of the seaman's instinctive faith in unpleasant medicine, and secretly the best part of his own hopes lay on the thing. But it was surely a wild growth, uncultivated. No person in their senses would ever deliberately eat the thing, and so far it was not to be found, for any price.
"'We found a boy who had a little English and told him that we would pay gold for it if they would bring some,' Dyer piped up. A group of native children had brought them the first example, mostly as a curiosity. "'Perhaps the seed husks in combination with another of the native fruits,' Dorset suggested, examining the hua jiao and stirring them with a finger. "'They might have been used on any number of dishes.' Keynes snorted, and dusting his hands as he straightened from the survey, he shook his head at Gong Su. "'No, let his innards have another day's rest and leave off all this unwholesome stuff. I'm increasingly of the opinion that the climate alone must cook it out of them, if there is to be any benefit to this enterprise at all.' He prodded the ground with a stick he had been using to turn over the vegetables. Dry and hard, several inches down, with only the stubborn frizz of short yellow grass to hold it together, the roots long and thin and spidery. A few days into March, they were deep in the local summer, and the steady hot weather made the hard-packed bare ground a baking stone, which fairly shimmered with heat during the peak of the day. Temeraire cracked an eye from his restorative drowse. "It is pleasant, but it is not so much warmer than the courtyard at Lochlagan," he said doubtfully, and in any case the suggestion was not a very satisfying one, as this cure could not be tried until the other dragons arrived. And for the moment they were alone, although the allegiance was expected now daily. As soon as the ship had come in flying distance of the Cape, Lawrence had packed the surgeons and the barest handful of men and supplies aboard Temeraire's back and taken them on ahead, that they might begin this desperate business of attempting to find the cure. It had not been merely an excuse. Their orders unequivocally stated, without the loss of a moment, and Maximus's ragged, gurgling cough was a constant spur to their sides. But in all honesty, neither had Lawrence been sorry in the least to go. The quarrel had not been made up at all. Lawrence had made attempts. Once, 3 weeks into the journey, he paused below decks as they passed one another by chance and removed his hat, but Riley only just touched his own brim and shouldered by, a quick surge of red colour mounting in his cheeks. This had stiffened Lawrence another week, long enough to make him refuse an offer of a share in one of the ship's milch goats, when the one which he had provided himself ran dry and was sacrificed instead to the dragons. Then regret won out again, and he said to Catherine, "'Perhaps we ought to invite the captain and the ship's officers to dinner,' on deck, and perfectly audible to anyone who might be curious, so when the invitation was sent it could not be mistaken as anything but a peace offering. But though Riley came, and his officers, he was utterly withdrawn all the meal, scarcely answering except when Catherine spoke to him, and never lifting his head from his plate. His officers, of course, would not speak without he or another captain addressing them, so it was a strange and silent affair, with even the younger aviators stifled by the uneasy sense that their manners did not suit the formality of the occasion. With such a standing quarrel among the officers, the men, who at no time made any great secret of their dislike of the dragons and their aviators, now made still less of one. Their hostility was leashed tightly by their fear, of course, even among those who had sailed with Lawrence and Temeraire on the previous voyage to China. Seven dragons made a great difference from one, and the sudden violent fits of coughing or sneezing which racked the poor creatures and ate at their strength only made them all the more fearsomely unpredictable to the common sailors, who could scarcely be made to ascend the foremast for its being too close to the beasts. What was worse, their officers corrected them none too sharply for their hesitation, with predictable results. Off the coast of the Horn she missed stays and had to be hurriedly box-hauled, because the men were slow moving on the dragon deck to shift over the jib and for-topmast staysail sheets. The manoeuvre jarred the dragons sadly about, setting them to coughing. And then nuisance in a moment nearly became tragedy. Nitidus went tumbling off Temeraire's back and knocked Lily's head askew. Her greasy tub of oiled sand slid with ponderous majesty over the edge of the dragon deck, and plunged immediately into the ocean. "'Over the side, dearest! Put your head over the side!' Catherine cried, her crew all of them to a man rushing to fetch one of the other replacements from the galley below. Lily had, with a tremendous effort, lunged forward, and now was clutching precariously at the edge of the ship, her head thrust out over the water, and her shoulders curled up into great knots as she tried to hold from coughing. Drops spilled from her bone spurs and smoked thin black hissing streams from the tarry sides of the ship. The allegiance was coming up through the wind, which blew them back against the wood.
"Shall I try and carry you away from the ship?"
Temeraire asked anxiously, wings half spread.
"Will you climb on my back?"
A dangerous manoeuvre at the best of times, with a dragon not dripping poisonous acid from her jaws, if Lily could even have managed to get upon him.
"Temeraire!" Lawrence called instead. "Will you see if you can break up the deck here?"
And Temeraire turned his head. Lawrence had only meant him to try and wrench the planks up, but instead Temeraire opened his jaws experimentally over the place and gave a queer, throttled version of his usual roar. Four planks cracked, one opening up along the ring pattern of the wood and dropping a knot straight down onto the startled heads of the galley cooks, crouched and covering themselves in terror. The space was nearly wide enough. With a few frantic moments of work, they had it enlarged, and Temeraire could reach down and heave up the tub directly. Lily pressed her jaw down into the sand and coughed, miserably and long, the fit worsened by her having repressed it at first. The oily sand hissed and smoked and stank with the fumes of the acid, and the deck gaped with the splintered hole, jagged edges threatening the dragon's bellies and letting the steam out of the galley which kept them warm.
"A damn disgrace! We might as well be sailing on a Frenchman,"
Lawrence said, angrily and not low. It had already been in his mind that tacking into the wind was incautious for so large and ponderous a vessel, better suited to old-fashioned wearing about, particularly when weighted down as she was with so many dragons. Riley had appeared on the quarter-deck, and across the ship faintly drifted the sound of his furious voice, calling Owens, the deck-officer, to account, and the men to fresh order. But Lawrence's voice carried too. There was a momentary pause in Riley's tirade, and then it finished more abruptly. Riley made his stiff and formal apologies for the incident only to Catherine, catching her as she came off the dragon deck to go below at the end of the day in what Lawrence could only imagine a design to avoid going up to speak to all of the aviators together. Her hair had come loose from its plait, her face was smudged with smoke and charred soot, and she had taken off her coat to pad under Lily's jaw where the bare edge of the tub had chafed. When he stopped her, she straightened and put her hand through her hair, loosening it entirely about her face, and his speech, undoubtedly prepared with care, quite fell apart. He only said, "I beg your pardon. Deeply regret," incoherently, and looked all confusion, until she interrupted tiredly. "Yes, of course. Only pray not again, and do let us have the carpenters make the repairs at once tomorrow. Good night," and brushed past him and went below. She meant nothing by it but that she was tired and wished to go to sleep, but it looked cutting to one who did not know her well enough to know her not in the least likely to resort to social stratagem to express offence, and perhaps Riley was ashamed. In any case, by morning all the ship's carpenters were at work on the dragon deck before even the aviators arose, with not a word of grumbling or fear, even if a great deal of sweating, particularly when the dragons roused and began watching with close interest. By the end of the day they had not only repaired the injury, but also put in a smooth hatch, which could be opened up into the galley if the operation required repeating. "Well, I call that handsome," Catherine said, though Lawrence felt it small amends for the earlier neglect, and when she added, "We ought to thank him for it," glancing at him, he said nothing and made no shifts to take her place. When she did go and ask Riley to dine again, this time Lawrence was careful to absent himself for the meal. It was an end to any hope of resolution. The rest of the journey passed in a cold distance between them, barely an exchange of greetings and only the briefest gesture when passing on deck or below, made rarer still as the Navy officers were quartered to the stern. There could be nothing comfortable in travelling aboard a ship while at unconcealed and bitter odds with her captain, the officers likewise cold if they were men who had never served with Lawrence himself, or stiff with discomfort otherwise. These constant chafing indignities of cold treatment from the ship's complement daily refreshed not only of the pain of the quarrel, but his resentment of Riley's anger. There was one saving grace, thus isolated from the life of the ship, and naturally brought into the closest contact with his fellow captains of the corps and their habits. Lawrence had sailed this time not merely in theory, but in practice as an aviator, a very different experience, and he startled himself by preferring it. They had little practical work to do.
By noon the daily slaughter was over. The dragon deck had been wholly stoned as best as could be managed without shifting the dragons too much. The younger officers examined on their schoolwork, and they were all at liberty. As much liberty as could be had within the space of a fully occupied dragon deck, and their half a dozen small cabins below.
"Do you mind if we knock down the bulkhead, Lawrence?"
Chennery had said, putting in his head scarcely 3 days into the journey, as Lawrence was writing letters in his cabin, a habit he had much neglected on shore of late.
"We want to set up a card table, but it is too wretchedly cramped."
An odd request, but he gave his assent. It was pleasant to have the larger space restored, and to write his letters with the companionable noise of their game and conversation. It became so settled a practice among them that the crewmen would have the bulkheads down without asking. No sooner had they finished dressing and restored only for sleeping. They took their meals almost always thus in common, a convivial and noisy atmosphere, with Catherine presiding and all talking across the table, heedless of etiquette, the junior officers squeezed in at the lower half in order of their promptness in arrival rather than their rank, and afterwards they gave the loyal toast standing on deck, followed with coffee and cigars in the company of their dragons, who were dosed with a posset against coughing, for what little relief it gave them, in the cooler hours of the evening. And after supper he would read to Temeraire, occasionally from the Latin or the French, with Temeraire translating for the other dragons. Lawrence assumed Temeraire particularly unusual among dragons for his scholarship. To better suit the rest, he kept at first to their small store of literature, and only then gave way to those mathematical and scientific treatises which Temeraire doted upon, and he himself found hard going. Many of these interested the company as little as Lawrence had expected, but he was surprised in reading a sadly wearing treatise upon geometry to be interrupted by Massoria, who said sleepily,
"Pray skip ahead a little. We do not need it proven. Anyone can tell it is perfectly correct,"
referring to great circles. They had no difficulty at all with the notion that a curved course, rather than a straight, was the shortest distance for sailing, which had confused Lawrence himself for a good week, when he had been obliged to learn it for the lieutenant's examination in the Navy. The next evening he was further interrupted in his reading by Nitidus and Dulcia taking up an argument with Temeraire about Euclid's postulates, one of which, referring to the principle of parallel lines, they felt quite unreasonable.
"I am not saying it is correct," Temeraire protested, "but you must accept it and go on. Everything else in science is built upon it."
"But what use is it, then?"
Nitidus said, getting agitated enough to flutter his wings and bat his tail against Maximus's side. Maximus murmured a small reproof without quite waking.
"Everything must be quite wrong if he begins so."
"It is not that it is wrong," Temeraire said, "only it is not so plain as the others."
"It is wrong. It is perfectly wrong,"
Nitidus cried decidedly, while Dulcia pointed out more calmly,
"Only consider a moment. If you should begin in Dover, and I a little south of London on the same latitude, and we should then both fly straight northward, we should certainly meet at the pole if we did not mistake our course. So what on earth is the sense of arguing that straight lines will never meet?"
"Well," Temeraire said, scratching at his forehead, "that is certainly true, but I promise you the postulate makes good sense when you consider all the useful calculations and mathematics which may be arrived at starting with the assumption. Why, all of the ship's design which we are upon is at base worked out from it, I imagine."
A piece of intelligence which made nervous Nitidus give the allegiance a very doubtful eye.
"But I suppose," Temeraire continued, "that we might try beginning without the assumption, or the contrary one."
And they put their heads together over Temeraire's sand table, and began to work out their own geometry, discarding those principles which seemed to them incorrect, and made a game of developing the theory, which entertained them a good deal more than most amusements Lawrence had ever seen dragons engage in, with those listening applauding particularly inventive notions as if they were performances. Shortly it became quite an all-encompassing project, engaging the attention of the officers as well as the dragons. The scant handful of aviators with good penmanship Lawrence was soon forced to press into service, for the dragons began to expand upon their cherished theory quicker than he alone could take their dictation, partly out of an intellectual curiosity, and partly because they very much liked the physical representation of their work, which they insisted on having separately copied out one for each of them, and treated in much the same way that Temeraire treated his much-beloved jewels.
"I will make you a handsome edition of it, bound up like that nice book which you see Lawrence reads from,"
Lawrence found Catherine saying to Lily shortly.
if only he will eat something more every day. Here, a few more bites of this tunny.
A bribery which succeeded where almost all else had failed.
Well, perhaps a little more,
Lily said, with a heroic air, adding,
and may it have gold hinges, too, like that one?
All this society Lawrence might have enjoyed, though a little ashamed to find himself preferring what he could not in justice call anything but a very ramshackle way of going on. But for all their courage and good humour, improved by the interest of the sea voyage, the dragons still coughed their lungs away, little by little. What would have otherwise seemed a pleasure cruise carried on under a ceaseless pall, where each morning the aviators came on the deck and put their crews to work washing away the blood-stained relics of the night's misery, and each night lay in their cabins trying to sleep to the rattling, wet accompaniment of the slow, weary hacking above. All their noise and gaiety had a forced and hectic edge, defiance of fear as much as real pleasure, fiddling as Rome burned. The sentiment was not confined to the aviators either. Riley might have had other excuses besides the political for preferring not to have Reverend Erasmus aboard, for the ship was already loaded besides him with a large number of passengers, most of them forced upon Riley by influence with the Admiralty, and well found in the article of luggage. Some number departed at Madeira to take other ship for the West Indies or Halifax from there, but others were bound for the Cape as settlers, and still others going on to India, an uneasy migration driven, Lawrence was forced to suspect, little though he liked to think so ill of perfect strangers, by a dread of invasion. He had some evidence for his suspicion. The passengers, when he chanced to overhear them speaking as they took the air on the windward side of the quarter-deck, spoke wistfully amongst themselves of the airy chances of peace, and pronounced Bonaparte's name with fear. There was little direct communication, separated as the dragon deck was, nor did the passengers make much effort to become friendly, but on a few occasions Reverend Erasmus joined Lawrence for dinner. Erasmus did not carry tales, of course, but asked,
"Captain, is it your opinion that invasion is a settled certainty?"
With a curiosity which to Lawrence spoke of its being a topic much discussed among the passengers with whom they ordinarily dined.
"I must call it settled that Bonaparte would like to try," Lawrence said. "And being a tyrant, he may do as he likes with his own army. But if he is so outrageously bold as to make a second attempt, where the first failed so thoroughly, I have every confidence he will be pushed off once again."
A patriotic exaggeration, but he had no notion of disparaging their chances publicly.
"I am glad to hear you say so,"
Erasmus said, and added after a moment thoughtfully,
"It must be a confirmation of the doctrine of original sin, I think, that all the noble promise of liberty and brotherhood, which the revolution in France first brought up to light, should have so quickly been drowned by blood and treasure. A man begins in corruption, and cannot achieve grace striving only for victory over the injustices of the world, without striving also for God, and obeying his commandments."
Lawrence, a little awkwardly, offered Erasmus the dish of stewed plums, in lieu of an agreement which should have felt dishonest. He was uneasily aware that he had not heard services for the better part of a year, barring the Sunday services on board, where Mr. Britton, the ship's official chaplain, droned through his sermon with a notable lack of either inspiration or sobriety, and for those Lawrence had often to sit beside Temeraire to keep him from interrupting.
"Do you suppose, sir," Lawrence ventured instead to ask, "the dragons are subject to original sin?"
This question had from time to time preyed upon him. He had quite failed to interest Temeraire in the Bible. Scripture rather induced the dragon to pursue such thoroughly blasphemous lines of questioning that Lawrence had very soon given it up entirely, from a superstitious feeling that this would only invite greater disaster. Erasmus considered and gave it as his opinion that they were not.
"For surely the Bible would mention it, if any had eaten of the fruit besides Adam and Eve. And though resembling the serpent in some particulars, the Lord said unto the serpent that upon its belly it should go, whereas dragons are as creatures of the air, and cannot be considered under the same interdiction," he added convincingly.
So it was with a heart lightened that Lawrence could return to the deck that evening to once again try and persuade Temeraire to take a little more to eat. Though Temeraire had not taken sick, he grew limp and faded in sympathy with the other dragon's illness,
and, ashamed of his appetite when his companions could not share in it, began to disdain his food. Lawrence coaxed and cajoled with little effect, until Gong Su came up to him on deck, and in flowery Chinese, of which Lawrence understood one word in six, but Temeraire certainly followed entire, offered his resignation in shame that his cooking was no longer acceptable. He dwelt at elaborate length upon the stain on his honour and that of his teacher and his family, which he would never be able to repair, and declared his intentions to somehow return home at the nearest opportunity, so that he might remove himself from the scene of failure.
"But it is very good, I promise, only I'm not hungry just now," Temeraire protested,
which Gong Su refused to credit as anything but a polite excuse, and added,
"Good cooking ought to make you hungry, even if you are not."
"But I am, only,"
Temeraire finally admitted, and looked sadly at his sleeping companions, and sighed when Lawrence gently said,
"My dear, you do them no good by starving yourself, and indeed some harm. You must be at your full strength and healthy when we reach the Cape."
"Yes, but it feels quite wrong to be eating and eating when everyone else has stopped and gone to sleep. It feels as though I'm sneaking food behind their backs, which they do not know about," Temeraire said.
A perplexing way of viewing the situation, as he had never shown the least compunction about out-eating his companions while they were awake, or jealously guarding his own meals from the attention of other dragons. But after this admission, they gave him his food in smaller portions throughout the day, while the other dragons were wakeful, and Temeraire exhibited no more very extreme reluctance, even though the others still refused any more food themselves. But he was not happy with their situation, any more than was Lawrence, and grew still less so as they travelled southward, Riley's caution keeping them near the shore. They did not put in at Cape Coast, or at Luanda, or Benguela, and from a distance these ports looked gaily enough, full of white sails clustering together, but there was reminder enough at hand of their grim commerce, the ocean being full of sharks that came eagerly leaping to the ship's wake, trained like dogs by the common passage of slave ships to and from those harbours.
"What city is that?"
Mrs. Erasmus asked him abruptly. She had come to take the air with her daughters, who were parading themselves decorously back and forth under a shared parasol, for once unattended by their mother.
"Benguela,"
Lawrence said, surprised to be addressed. In nearly 2 months of sailing she had never spoken to him direct before. She was never forward on any occasion, but rather in the habit of keeping her head bowed and her voice low, her English still heavily accented with Portuguese when she used it at all. He knew from Erasmus that she had gained her manumission only a little while before her marriage, not through the indulgence of her master, but by his ill fortune. That gentleman, a landowner from Brazil, had gone on business to France, passenger on a merchant ship taken in the Atlantic. She and his other slaves had been made free when the prize had been brought into Portsmouth. She was drawn up very tall and straight, both her hands gripping the rail, though she had excellent sea-legs and scarcely needed the support, and she stood a long time looking there, even after the little girls had grown tired of their promenade and abandoned both parasol and decorum to go scrambling over the ropes with Emily and Dyer. A great many slave ships went to Brazil from Benguela, Lawrence recalled. He did not ask her, but offered her instead his arm to go below again, when at last she turned away, and some refreshment. She refused both, with only a shake of her head, and called her children back to order with a quick, low word. They left off their game, abashed, and she took them down below. Past Benguela there were no more slave ports, at least, both from the hostility of the natives to the trade and the inhospitable coastline, but the oppressive atmosphere on board was no less. Together Lawrence and Temeraire often went aloft to escape, flying in closer to shore than Riley would risk the allegiance, and pacing her from there, so they might watch the African coastline wear away. Here impenetrably forested, here spilling yellow rock and yellow sand into the ocean, here the shore crammed with lazy seals, then the long stretch of endless orange desert, bound regularly in thick banks of fog, which made the sailors wary. Almost hourly the officer of the watch called for them to take soundings of the ocean floor, voices muffled and oddly far away in the mist. Very occasionally a few black men might be glimpsed on shore, observing them in turn with wary attention, but for the most part there was only silence, watchful silence, except for the shrieking of birds.
"Lawrence, "Surely we can reach Cape Town from here quicker than the ship can go," Temeraire said at last, grown weary of the oppressive atmosphere. They were still nearly a month's sailing from that port, however, and the country too dangerous to risk a long overland passage. The interior of the continent was notoriously impenetrable and savage, and had without a trace swallowed whole parties of men. More than one courier dragon tempted off the coastal route had likewise vanished. But the suggestion appealed, with its prospects of quitting sooner the unhappy conditions of the voyage, and advancing more quickly the crucial research which was their purpose. Lawrence persuaded himself that he should not be derelict in going on early, once they should be near enough to make the flight one which might be accomplished in a day, if a strenuous one. With this incentive, Temeraire was easily induced to eat properly and go for long and uninteresting circular flights around the ship to build up his strength, and no one else raised objection to their departure.
"If you are quite sure you will reach in safety," Catherine said,
with only the most obligatory reluctance. None of the aviators could help but share the urgent desire to have the work begun, now they were so close.
"You shall, of course, do as you please," Riley said, when officially informed, without looking Lawrence in the face, and bent his head down again over his maps to pretend to be making calculations, a pretense which succeeded not at all, Lawrence being perfectly aware that Riley could not do so much as a sum in his head without scratching it out on paper.
"I will not take all the crew," Lawrence told Ferris, who looked dismal, but even he did not protest overmuch. Keynes and Dorset would come, of course, and Gong Su. The cooks, in the employ of Prince Yongxing on their previous visit, had experimented with great enthusiasm on the local produce, which thus formed one of the surgeon's foremost hopes of reproducing the cure.
"Do you suppose you can prepare these ingredients in the same way as they might have used?" Lawrence asked Gong Su.
"I am not an imperial chef," Gong Su protested,
and to Lawrence's dismay explained that the style of cooking in the south of China, whence he hailed, was entirely different.
"I will try my poor best, but it is not to be compared, although northern cooking is not very good, usually," he added, in a burst of parochialism.
Roland and Dyer came to be assistants to him, and run and fetch in the markets, their slight weight a negligible burden. For the rest, Lawrence packed aboard a chest of gold, and took little more baggage than his sword and pistols, and a pair of clean shirts and stockings.
"I do not feel the weight at all. I am sure I could fly for days," Temeraire said, grown still more urgent.
Lawrence had forced himself to let caution keep them back a full week, so they were now less than 200 miles distant. Still a desperately long single day's flight, but not an impossible one.
"If the weather holds until morning," Lawrence said.
One final invitation he made, which he did not think would be accepted, to Reverend Erasmus.
"Captain Barclay begs me inform you he would be happy if you continued aboard as his guests," Lawrence said, rather more elegantly than Barclay's,
"Yes, of course, damn formal nonsense, we're not going to put them overboard, are we?"
could be said to have deserved. "But of course you are my personal guest, and welcome to join me if you would prefer it."
"Hannah, perhaps you would rather not?"
Erasmus said, looking to his wife. She lifted her head from her small text on the native language, whose phrases she was forming silently with her mouth.
"I do not mind," she said, and indeed climbed up to Temeraire's back without any sign of alarm, settling the girls around her and chiding them firmly for their own anxiety.
"We will see you in Cape Town," Lawrence told Ferris, and saluted Harcourt.
With one grateful leap they were gone, flying and flying over clean ocean, with a good fresh wind at their heels. A day and a night of flying had seen them coming in over the bay at dawn, the flat-topped fortress wall of Table Mount standing dusty and golden behind the city, light spilling onto the striated rock face and the smaller, jagged sentinel peaks to either side. The bustling town crammed full the crescent slice of level ground at the base of the slope, with the Castle of Good Hope at its heart upon the shore, its outer walls forming a star shape from above, with a butter-yellow pentagon of the fort nested within, gleaming in the early morning as her cannon fired the welcoming salute to leeward. The parade grounds where Temeraire was lodged were beside the castle, only a few dragon lengths from where the ocean came grumbling onto the sandy beach, a distance inconvenient when the wind was blowing too strongly at high tide, but which otherwise made a pleasant relief against the summer heat. Although the courtyard enclosed within the fort itself was large enough to house a few dragons in times of emergency,
It would not have made a comfortable situation either for the soldiers stationed in the castle barracks or for Temeraire. And happily, the grounds had been much improved since their last visit, breaking their journey to China. While the couriers no longer flew routes this far south, too remote for their failing strength, a fast frigate had been sent on ahead of the allegiance with dispatches to warn the acting governor, Lieutenant General Grey, both of their arrival and, secretly, of their urgent purpose. He had widened the grounds to house all the formation and put up a low fence around.
"I'm not afraid you will be pestered, but it may keep away prying eyes and stifle some of this damned noise," he said to Lawrence, referring to the protests of the colonists at their arrival. "It is just as well that you have come on ahead. It will give them some time to get over the notion before we have 7 dragons all in a lump. The way they wail, you would think they had never heard of a formation at all."
Grey had himself reached the Cape only in January. He was the Lieutenant Governor and would soon be superseded by the arrival of the Earl of Caledon, so that his position, with all the awkwardness of a temporary situation, lacked a certain degree of authority, and he was much beset by cares not a little increased by their arrival. The townspeople disliked the British occupation, and the settlers, who had established their farms and estates farther out into the countryside and down the coast, despised it, and indeed anything in the shape of government that would have interfered with their independence, which they considered dearly and sufficiently paid for by the risk which they ran in pressing the frontier into the wild interior of the continent. The advent of a formation of dragons was viewed by them all with the deepest suspicion, especially as they were not to be permitted to know the real purpose. Thanks to much slave labour cheaply acquired in the earlier years of the colony, the settlers had come to disdain manual labour for themselves and their families, and their farms and vineyards and herds had expanded to take advantage of the many hands which they could forcibly put to the work. Slaves were not exported from the Cape. They wanted rather more slaves than they could get. Malay, by preference, or purchased from West Africa, but not disdaining either the unhappy servitude of the native Khoi tribesmen, who, if they were not precisely slaves, were very little less constrained, and their wages unworthy of the term. Having thus arranged to be outnumbered, the colonists now exerted themselves to maintain the serenity of their establishments by harsh restrictions and an absolutely free hand with punishment. A resentment yet lingered that under the previous British government the torture of slaves had been forbidden. On the further outskirts of the town might yet be observed the barbaric custom of leaving the corpse of a hanged slave upon his gibbet, as an illustrative example to his fellows of the cost of disobedience. The colonists were well informed also of the campaign against the trade, which they viewed with indignation as likely to cut them off from additional supply, and Lord Allendale's name was not unknown to them as a mover of the cause.
"And if that were not enough," Grey said tiredly, when they had been in residence a few days, "you brought this damned missionary with you. Now half the town thinks the slave trade has been abolished, the other half that their slaves are all to be set free at once and given license to murder them in their beds, and all are certain you are here to enforce it. I must ask you to present me to the fellow. He must be warned to keep more quiet. It is a miracle he has not been already stabbed in the street."
Erasmus and his wife had taken over a small establishment of the London Missionary Society, lately abandoned by the death of its previous tenant, a victim of malarial fevers, and in far from an ordered state. There was neither a school nor a church building yet, only a mortally plain little house graced by a few depressed and straggling trees, and a bare plot of land around it meant for a vegetable garden, where Mrs. Erasmus was presently labouring in the company of her daughters and several of the young native women, who were being shown how to stake tomato plants. She stood up when Lawrence and Grey came into view, and with a quiet word left the girls at work while she led the two of them inside the house. Built in the Dutch style, the walls made of thick clay, with broad wooden beams exposed above supporting the thatched roof. The windows and door all stood open to let air the smell of fresh whitewash. Inside the house was only a single long room divided into three, and Erasmus was seated in the midst of a dozen native boys scattered around on the floor, showing them the letters of the alphabet upon a slate. He rose to greet them and sent the boys outside to play, an eruption of gleeful yelling drifting in directly they had gone spilling out into the street, and Mrs. Erasmus disappeared into the kitchen with a clatter of kettle and pot.
"You are very advanced, sir, for 3 days' residence," Grey said, looking after the horde of boys in some dismay.
"There is a great thirst for learning, and for the gospel too," Erasmus said with pardonable satisfaction. "Their parents come at night after they have finished working in the fields, and we have already had our first service." He invited them to sit, but as there were only two chairs it would have made an awkward division, and they remained standing.
"I will come at once to the point," Gray said. "There have been, I am afraid, certain complaints made."
He paused and repeated, "Certain complaints," uneasily, though Erasmus had said nothing.
"You understand, sir, we have but lately taken the colony, and the settlers here are a difficult lot. They have made their own farms and estates, and with some justice consider themselves entitled to be masters of their own fate. There is some sentiment—"
"In short," he said abruptly, "you would do very well to moderate your activity. You need not perhaps have so many students. Take three or four, most promising, let the rest return to work. I am informed the labour of the students is by no means easily spared," he added weakly. Erasmus listened, saying nothing, until Gray had done. Then he said,
"Sir, I appreciate your position. It is a difficult one. I am very sorry I cannot oblige you."
Gray waited, but Erasmus said nothing more whatsoever, offering no ground for negotiation. Gray looked at Lawrence a little helplessly, then, turning back, said,
"Sir, I will be frank. I am by no means confident of your continued safety, if you'll persist. I cannot assure it."
"I did not come to be safe, but to bring the word of God," Erasmus said, smiling and immovable, and his wife brought in the tea-tray.
"Madam," Gray said to her, she poured the cups at the table, "I entreat you to use your influence. I beg you to consider the safety of your children."
She raised her head abruptly. The kerchief which she had been wearing outside to work had slipped, and by pulling her hair back away from her face revealed a dull, scarred brand upon her forehead, the initials of a former owner, blurred but legible still, and superimposed on an older, tattooed marking of abstract pattern. She looked at her husband. He said gently,
"We will trust in God, Hannah, and in His will."
She nodded and made Gray no direct answer, but went silently back outside to the garden. There was, of course, nothing more to be said. Gray sighed when they had taken their leave, and said dismally,
"I suppose I must put a guard upon the house."
A heavy, moist wind was blowing from the southeast, draping the Table Mount in a blanket of clouds, but it abated that evening, and the Allegiance was sighted the next afternoon by the castle lookout, heralded by the fire of the signal guns. The atmosphere of suspicion and hostility was a settled thing by then throughout the town, although sentiments less bitter would have sufficed to make her arrival unsettling for the inhabitants. Lawrence watched her come in, by Gray's invitation, from a pleasant, cool antechamber set atop the castle, and seeing her from this unfamiliar and reversed direction was struck by the overwhelming impression of terrible force. Not only the sheer vastness of her size, but the hollow eyes of her brute armament of 32-pounders glaring angrily out of portholes, and what seemed at this distance a veritable horde of dragons coiled upon her deck, uncountable for their lying so intertwined that their heads and tails could not quite be separated one from another. She advanced slowly into harbour, dwarfing all the shipping in the port into insignificance, and a kind of grim silence descended upon the town as she fired her salute to the fort. A rolling thunder of guns that echoed back from the face of the mountain and settled gently upon the town like a fog. Lawrence could taste the powder smoke at the back of his mouth. The women and children had vanished from the streets by the time her anchors were let plunging down. It was dreadful to see how little they had truly to fear when Lawrence went down to the shore and had himself rowed across to aid with the manoeuvres underway to get the dragons transferred off the deck. The long, cramped journey had stiffened them all badly, and though the Allegiance had made good time, still every day of the 2 months and more had eaten steadily away at their strength. The castle was established only steps from the sandy beach, the parade grounds beside it, but even this short flight wearied them now. Nitidus and Dulcia, the smallest, came across first, to give the others more room,
They drew deep breaths and lunged valiantly off the deck, their short wings beating sluggish and slow, and giving them very little lift, so that their bellies nearly scraped the top of the low fence around the parade grounds. They landed heavily and sank down into a heap on the warm ground without even folding their wings back. Masoria and Immortalis then dragged themselves up so wearily to their feet that Temeraire, who was watching anxiously from the grounds, called out,
"Pray, wait, and I will come and carry you in,"
and ferried them one after another upon his back, heedless of the small scrapes and scratches which he took from their claws as they clutched at him for balance. Lily nosed Maximus gently on the deck.
"Yes, go on. I will be there in a moment,"
he said sleepily, without opening his eyes. She gave a dissatisfied rumble of concern.
"We will get him across, never fear," Harcourt said coaxingly,
and at last Lily was persuaded to submit to their precautionary arrangements for her own transfer. A muzzle had to be fitted over her head, from which a large metal platter was suspended beneath her jaws, and this covered with more of the oiled sand. Riley had come to see them off. Harcourt turned to him and held out her hand, saying,
"Thank you, Tom. I hope we will be coming back across soon, and you will visit us on land."
He took her hand in an awkward, sideways grip and bowed over it, somewhere between saluting her and shaking her hand, and backed away stiffly. He still avoided looking at Lawrence at all. Harcourt put her boot on the railing and jumped up to Lily's back. She took hold of the harness to steady it, and Lily unfurled her great wings, the feature from which the breed took its name, rippled along the edges in narrow bands of black and white, with the dark blue of her body shading across their length to a brilliant deep orange, the colour of old marmalade. They shone iridescent in the sun. Fully extended, they made double the length of her entire body, and once she had fairly launched herself aloft, she scarcely needed to beat them, but glided stately along without great exertion. They managed the flight across without spilling too much of the sand, or dripping acid upon the castle battlements or the dock, and then there was only Maximus left upon the deck. Barclay spoke to him quietly, and with a great heaving sigh, the enormous, regal copper pushed himself up to his feet, the Allegiance herself rocking a little in the water. He took two slow, gouty steps to the edge of the dragon deck and sighed again. His shoulder muscles creaked as he tried his wings, and then let them sink against his back again. His head drooped.
"I could try,"
Temeraire offered, calling from shore, quite impractically. Maximus still made almost two of him by weight.
"I am sure I can manage it,"
Maximus said hoarsely, then bent his head and coughed a while and spat more greenish phlegm out over the side. He did not move. Temeraire's tail was lashing at the air, and then, with an air of decision, he plunged into the surf and came swimming out to them instead. He reared up with his forelegs on the edge of the ship and thrust his head up over the railing to say,
"It is not very far. Pray come in the water. I am sure together we can swim to the shore."
Barclay looked at Keynes, who said,
"A little sea-bathing can do no harm, I expect, and perhaps even some good. It is warm enough in all conscience, and we will have sun another 4 hours at this time of year to dry him off."
"Well, then, into the water with you,"
Barclay said, gruffly, patting Maximus's side and stepping back. Crouching down awkwardly, Maximus plunged four quarters first into the ocean. The massive anchor cables complained with deep voices as the Allegiance recoiled from the force of his leap, and 10-foot ripples swelled up and went shuddering away from him to nearly overturn some of the unsuspecting slighter vessels riding at anchor in the bay. Maximus shook water from his head, bobbing up and down, and paddled a few strokes along before stopping, sagging in the water. The buoyancy of the air sacs kept him afloat, but he listed alarmingly.
"Lean against me, and we shall go together,"
Temeraire said, swimming up to his side to brace him up. And little by little they progressed towards the shore until the ocean floor came up abruptly to meet them, clouds of white sand stirring up like smoke, and Maximus could stop to rest, half-submerged yet, with the waves lapping against his sides.
"It is pleasant in the water,"
he said, despite another fit of coughing.
"I do not feel so tired here."
But he had still to be got out and on to the shore. No little task, and he managed it only in slow, easy stages, with all the assistance which Temeraire and the oncoming tide could offer,
crawling the final dozen yards nearly on his belly. Here they let him rest, and brought him the choicest cuts from the dinner which Gong Su had spent the day preparing to tempt the dragon's appetites after their exertion. Local cattle, fat and tender, spit-roasted, with a crust of pepper and salt pressed into their flesh, as a flavouring strong enough to overcome the dulling effect of the illness on the dragon's senses, and stuffed with their own stewed tripes. Maximus ate a little, drank a few swallows of the water which they carried out to him in a large tub, and afterwards fell back into sluggish torpor, coughing, and slept the night through on shore, with the ocean still coming in and his tail riding up on the waves like a tethered boat. Only in the cool early hours of the morning did they get him the rest of the way to the parade grounds, and there settled him in the best place at its edge beneath the young stand of camphor trees, where he might have a little shade as well as sun, and very near the well which had been sunk to easily bring them water. Barclay saw him established, and then took off his hat and went to the water trough to duck his head, and bring a couple of cupped handfuls to his mouth to drink, and wipe his red and sweating face.
"It is a good place," he said, his head bent. "A good place. He will be comfortable here."
And ending abruptly, went inside the castle, where they breakfasted together in silence. They did not discuss the matter, but no discussion was required. They all knew Maximus would not leave again without a cure, and they had brought him otherwise to his grave. Chapter 7 Aboard they had counted every day. They had hurried. They had fretted. Now they were arrived and could only sit and wait, while the surgeons went through their fastidious experiments and refused to give any opinion whatsoever. More outrageous local supplies were brought to them in succession, presented to Temeraire, occasionally tried on one of the sick dragons, and discarded again. This proceeded without any sign of useful effect, and on one unfortunate occasion again distressed Temeraire's digestive system, so that the shared dragon midden took on a very unpleasant quality, and had at once to be filled in and a new one dug. The old one promptly sprang up a thick carpet of grass and a bright pink weedy flower which to their great exasperation could not be rooted out, and attracted a species of wasps viciously jealous of their territory. Lawrence did not say so, but it was his private opinion that all this experimentation was only half-hearted, and meant to occupy their attention while Keynes waited for the climate to do its work, though Dorset made careful notes of each trial in his regular hand, going from one dragon to the next in rounds thrice daily, and inquiring with heartless indifference how much the patient had coughed since the last inquiry, what pains he suffered, how he ate. This last was never much. At the close of the first week, Dorset finished his latest interrogation of Captain Warren on the condition of Nitidus, and shut his book and went and spoke quietly with Keynes and the other surgeons.
"I suppose they are all prodigious clever, but if they keep on with these secret councils and telling us nothing, I will begin to want to push their noses in for them," Warren said, coming to join the rest of them at the card table, which had been set up under a pavilion in the middle of the grounds.
The game was mostly a polite fiction to occupy the days. They did not have much attention to the cards at any time, and now had none, all of them instead watching the surgeons as they huddled together in deep discussion. Keynes evaded them skilfully for two more days, and finally, cornered into giving some report, said crabbily, "It is too soon to tell," but admitted that they had seen some improvement, so far as they could determine merely from the climate. The dragons had shown some resurrection of appetite and energy, and they coughed less.
"It will be no joke, ferrying all the corps down here," Little said quietly, after their first early jubilation. "How many transports have we in all?"
7, I think, if the Lyonnais is out of dry dock," Lawrence said.
There was a pause, then he added strongly,
"But consider, we scarcely need a ship of 100 guns only to move dragons. Transports are meant foremost to deliver them to the front."
This being not entirely a misrepresentation, but only because there was little cause other than war to go to the difficulty and expense of shifting dragons about.
"We can put them on barges at Gibraltar instead, and send them along the coast with an escort of frigates to keep the French off them."
It sounded well enough, but they all knew that even if not inherently impractical, still such an operation was wholly unlikely to be carried out on the scale of the entire corps. They might return with the dragons of their own formation preserved, but such a cure was likely to be denied half their comrades or more.
"It is better than nothing," Chenery said a little defiantly.
and more than we had. There's not a man of the corps who would not have taken such odds if offered him. But the odds would be unequal ones. Longwings and regal coppers, heavy combat dragons, and the rarer breeds, no expense or difficulty would be spared to preserve. But for the rest, common yellow reapers or quick-breeding Winchesters, older dragons likely to be difficult when their captains died, the weaker or less skilled flyers, these a brutal political calculus would not count worth the saving, and leave to die in neglect and misery, isolated undoubtedly in the most distant quarantines which could be arranged. Their cautious satisfaction was dimmed by this shadow, and Sutton and Little took it worst. Their dragons were both yellow reapers, and Massoria was 40. But even guilt could not extinguish all their eager hope. They slept very little that night, counting coughs instead, tallies to go into Dorset's book. And in the morning, with only a little coaxing, Nitidus was persuaded to try his wings. Lawrence and Temeraire went with him and Warren for company, and in case the little Pascal's blue should exhaust his strength. And Nitidus was panting hoarsely from his mouth and coughing now and again as they flew. They did not go far. The local hunger for grazing land and timber had scraped the fields and hillsides down to scrubby low grass all the way to the base of Table Mountain and its satellite peaks, where the slopes grew prohibitive. Loose conglomerations of grey and yellow rock in stepped terraces, like old rotting stone walls held together by grass and green moss, and clayey dirt for mortar. They halted there and rested on the loose, scrubby ground in the shadow of the sheer cliff wall. An extensive scurrying went on in the underbrush as the small game fled from their presence, small furry creatures like brown badgers.
"It is a very strange sort of mountain," Temeraire observed, craning his head to look back and forth along the long ridge of the peak above them,
sheared smooth and flat as if by a levelling knife.
"Yes, oh very. And how hot it is,"
Nitidus said, meaninglessly and half asleep, and tucked his head beneath his wing to nap. They let him sleep in the sun, and Temeraire yawned too and followed his example. Lawrence and Warren stood together looking back down into the deep bowl of the harbour, where it ran down into the ocean, the Allegiance a toy ship among ants at this distance. The neat geometric pentagon of the castle was drawn in yellow upon the dark earth, with the dragon's small, still lumps upon the parade grounds beside it. Warren took off his glove and rubbed the back of his hand across his brow to wipe the sweat off. He left a careless smudge.
"I suppose you would go back to the Navy if it were you?" he asked.
"If they would have me," Lawrence said.
"A fellow might buy a cavalry commission, I suppose," Warren said. "There will be no shortage of soldiers needed if Bonaparte continues to have things his way. But it could hardly compare."
They were silent a while, considering the unpleasant options which would be the portion of so many men cast effectively on shore by the death of the dragons on which they served.
"Lawrence," Warren went on after a moment, "this fellow Riley, what sort of a man is he? Ordinarily, I mean. I know you were lately both standing on your honour."
Lawrence was astonished to be appealed to in such a way, but answered, "A gentleman, and one of the finest officers of my acquaintance. I cannot say a word against him, personally." He wondered very much what should have spurred the inquiry. With the Allegiance confined by her orders to harbour until the dragons should once again be ready to depart, Riley had of course come to the castle and dined with General Grey on more than one occasion. Lawrence had absented himself, but Catherine and the other captains had gone more often than not. Perhaps some quarrel had taken place to give rise to such a question, and Lawrence hoped that perhaps Warren would elaborate. But he only nodded and changed the subject to the likelihood that the wind would change before their return. So Lawrence's curiosity remained unsatisfied, and the question had only the effect of making him sorry afresh for the quarrel, which he now supposed should never be made up, and the termination of their friendship.
"Nitidus does seem better, does he not?" Temeraire murmured to Lawrence, in confidential tones audible only to anyone within 20 feet, while they made ready to return.
Lawrence could answer wholeheartedly that he thought so as well, and when they returned to the parade grounds the lightweight ate almost to his healthy standard, putting a period to 2 goats before he again fell asleep. On the morrow Nitidus did not want to repeat the exercise, and Dulcia would only go half so far before dropping down to rest.
"But she did for a whole one of those oxen, a yearling calf,"
Chenery said, doing for a substantial glass of whisky and water himself.
"And a damn good sign, I call it. She's not eaten so much in a 6 month."
The next day neither of them would go, but sat down again almost as soon as they had been persuaded to get up on their feet, and begged to be excused.
"It is too hot,"
Nitidus complained, and asked for more water. Dulcia said more plaintively,
"I would rather sleep some more, if you please."
Keynes put a cup to her chest to listen, and, straightening up, shook his head. None of the others could be stirred much beyond their sleeping places. When the tallies over which the aviators had laboured were examined closely together, the dragons did indeed cough less, but it was not much less, and this benefit had been exchanged, their anxious observers soon perceived, for listlessness and lethargy. The intense heat made the dragons sleepy and disinclined to move, the interest of their new surroundings having now palled, and the brief resurgence in their appetites had evidently been spurred only by the better eating available on shore, as compared to the late stages of the sea journey.
"I would not have regretted it, not at all,"
Sutton muttered, hunched over the table and speaking to himself, but so violently that it could not but be overheard.
"How could there be any regret in such circumstances? There could be none!"
In anguish, as great as though his guilt over the prospect of a cure for his own Masoria, when so many others might be left to die, had been the very cause of failure. And Little was so white and stricken that Chennery took him into his tent, and plied him with rum until he slept.
"The rate of progress of the disease has been slowed," Keynes said at the close of their second week. "It is not an inconsequential benefit," he added. "Little consolation for their better hopes."
Lawrence took Temeraire away flying and kept him on the shore all the night, to spare his fellow captains at least briefly the contrast between Temeraire's health and that of their own dragons. He felt keenly his own portion of guilt and shame, the confused mirror of Sutton's unhappiness and Little's. He would not have contemplated trading Temeraire's health for all the rest, and though he knew his fellow captains would understand perfectly, and feel each of them the same for their own partner, in as irrational a way he felt the failure a punishment for this private selfishness. In the morning, new sails stood in the harbour. The Fiona, a quick-sailing frigate, had come in during the night with dispatches. Catherine opened them slowly at the breakfast-table and read off the names. Auctoritas, Prolixus, Laudabilis, Repugnatis, gone since the new year. Lawrence, too, had a letter from his mother.
"All is desolation. We are done for at least another year, and likely more, if the government should fall again. The motion was carried in the Commons. The Lords again defeated it, despite everything which could be done, and a most extraordinary speech by Mr. Wilberforce, which should have moved the possessor of any soul deserving of the name. The newspapers, at least, are with us, and speak with all the outrage merited by so disgusting an event. The Times writes, 'Those naysayers who give no thought to the future may sleep easy this night. The others must try, if they can, to find rest, in the sure knowledge that they have laid up a store of misery and sorrow which they shall be asked to repay, if not in this world, then in that to come. Only a just reproach.'"
He folded it, and put it aside in his coat pocket. He had no heart to read further, and they left the dining-room a silent party. The castle barracks were large enough to house a larger party than they made, but with the disease marching implacable along, the captains by silent agreement preferred to stay closer by their sick beasts. The other officers and men not wishing to be outdone, a small battalion of tents and pavilions sprang up about the grounds, where they most of them spent their days and nights, barring the infrequent rain. All the better to discourage the occasional invasion of the local children, who remembered Temeraire's last visit of a year ago enough to have lost some of their fear. They had now formed the game of working one another up until one, challenged past the point of endurance, would make a mad, flurrying dash through the parade grounds among the sleeping dragons, before fleeing back out again to receive the congratulations of his peers. These escalating adventures Sutton quelled for good one afternoon, when a boy dashing in slapped his hand against Masoria's side and startled her out of a rare, sound sleep. She reared up her head into snorting wakefulness, and the guilty culprit fell over into the dust, scuttling crab-like backwards on hands and feet and rump in his alarm, much greater than hers. Sutton rose from the card-table and went over to take the boy by the arm, heaving him up to his feet.
"Bring me a switch, Holden," he said to his runner,
and leading the intruder stumbling out of the grounds, applied himself with vigour, while the other children scattered and ran a little distance away, peeking out from behind the bushes.
At length the unlucky boy's howls faded to whimpering sobs, and Sutton returned to the table.
"I beg your pardon, gentlemen," he said, and they resumed their desultory play. There were no more incursions that day.
But Lawrence woke shortly after dawn the subsequent morning, and went out of his own tent to find a loud squabbling at their gates, two knots of older children wrestling and kicking at each other with a polyglot confusion of yelling, a handful of Malay and scruffy Dutch boys together, and against them a smaller band of the black natives of the Cape, the Khoi, although previously the two groups had all been equal offenders together. Unhappily their quarrel had roused the dragons, who thus began an hour early their morning bouts of coughing. Maximus, who had suffered badly during the night, gave a heavy, sighing groan. Sutton came rushing out of his tent in a mottled rage, and Barclay would have set among the lot of them with the flat of his sword, if Lieutenant Ferris had not thrown himself in the way, his arms outspread, as Emily and Dyer scrambled out from the dusty melee.
"We did not mean to,"
she said, muffled by the hand with which she tried to staunch her bloodied nose.
"Only they both brought some."
By some evil genius, the two parties had at the same time, after weeks of searching, finally uncovered some of the mushroom. Now the rival bands were squabbling over their claim to be the first to present the enormous mushroom caps, 2 feet and more across, and stinking even in their natural state to high heaven.
"Lieutenant Ferris, let us have a little order, if you please," Lawrence said, raising his voice, "and let them know they will all of them be paid. There's not the least need for this fuss."
Despite attempts to convey this reassurance, it took some time to drag apart the angry combatants, who, if they did not speak one another's language, certainly understood the salient phrases which were being exchanged, at least well enough to keep their tempers fired up, and who kicked and swung their arms at each other even when hauled apart by main force. They stopped abruptly, however. Temeraire, having woken up also, put his head over the low fence to snuffle with appreciation at the caps, left abandoned by both sides in the grass while they attempted to settle their quarrel by might at arms.
Said Temeraire,
and licked his chops. In spite of their earlier bravado, the boys did not quite dare to run at him and snatch them away from his jaws, but they all joined into a general cry of protest, seeing themselves on the verge of being robbed, and as a consequence were at last convinced to settle down and accept their payment, counted out in gold coins with precisely equal amounts on both sides. The Dutch and Malay contingent were inclined to grumble, as theirs had been the larger specimen, with 3 separate caps arranged upon a single stem, as compared to the 2 upon the mushroom brought by the Khoi. But a speaking glare from Sutton silenced them all.
"Bring us some more, and you shall be paid again," Lawrence said.
But this produced discouraged looks rather than hope, and they looked at his closed-up purse a little resentfully before they scattered away to quarrel now amongst themselves over the division of spoils.
"They cannot be edible,"
Catherine said doubtfully in a stifled voice, her handkerchief pressed over her mouth as she examined the things. Growths, more than proper mushrooms, lopsided and bulging oddly, a pallid fish-belly white irregularly spotted with brown. But Temeraire said,
"Certainly I remember these. They were very tasty,"
and only regretfully let Gong Su carry the mushrooms away, which he did by holding them at arm's length, gingerly, with 2 very long sticks. Having learnt from their earlier experience, they set up the cauldron out of doors instead of within the castle kitchens, Gong Su directing the crews to lay a substantial bonfire underneath the big iron pot, suspended from stakes, with a ladder beside it so he might stir from afar with a long-handled wooden ladle.
"Perhaps the red peppercorns?" Temeraire offered. "Or maybe the green. I do not quite remember,"
he said apologetically, as Gong Su consulted his spice-box at length in attempts to reproduce the former recipe. Keynes shrugged and said,
"Stew the thing and have done. If we must rely on your reproducing some trick of spicing invented a year ago by 5 cooks, we may as well go back to England now."
They stewed it all the morning, Temeraire bending over the pot, sniffing at the bouquet as critically as any drinker of wine, and making further suggestions, until at last he licked up a taste from the rim of the cauldron and pronounced it a success.
"Or at least it seems to me familiar. And it is very good,"
he added, to an audience of none. They had all been driven away to the edge of the clearing, choking, and barely heard him. Poor Catherine had been taken violently ill and was still retching behind a bush. They covered their noses and carried Maximus the posset, which he seemed to enjoy, even stirring himself so far as to put a talon inside the cauldron to tip it over, so he might lick out the last scrapings. After an initial somnolence, it put him in a thoroughly good mood, so that he roused up and even ate all of the tender young kid which Barclay had acquired for his dinner, more in hope than in expectation, and asked for more, though he fell asleep again before this could be arranged. Barclay would have woken him to feed him another goat, and his own surgeon Gaiters agreed, but Dorset took the strongest exception and would have denied him even the first, on the grounds that the digestive processes might interfere with the effect of the posset. This shortly devolved into an argument as violent as hissing whispers could make it, until Keynes said finally, "Let him sleep," overruling both. "But henceforth we will feed him as much as he can eat, after each dose. The importance of restoring his weight cannot be overstated to the cause of his general preservation. Dulcia is better fleshed. We will try her on the posset tomorrow as well, without food."
"I ate it with some oxen, or perhaps some antelope," Temeraire said reminiscently, nosing a little sadly at the empty pot. "There was some very nice fat. I remember that particularly, the fat with a mushroom sauce. So perhaps it was the oxen after all."
The local breed possessing a queer, fatty shoulder hump over the four quarters. This single meal had been all Temeraire's prior experience, but Keynes had divided their meagre sample, and beginning with the following morning, Maximus and Dulcia fed upon it 3 days in succession, until all the supply was gone. As Lawrence remembered it, the concoction had made Temeraire mostly drowsy, and so Maximus became, but on the third day Dulcia alarmed them all by turning unexpectedly manic with excitement on the repeated dose, and nearly insisting on going for a long, hectic flight, quite likely beyond her strength, and at the least sure not to be beneficial to her health.
"I can! I'm well! I am well!"
she cried, her wings fanning at the air, and she went hopping about the parade grounds evasively on her back legs, with the surgeons chasing after her in attempts to calm her. Chenery was of no use. He had spent the intervening days since the failure of their first hopes keeping himself and Captain Little half-drunk at all times, and in defiance of all the pessimism which Keynes could inflict, would happily have thrown himself aboard and gone. Dulcia was finally persuaded not to go flying off, with the temptation of a couple of lambs dressed hastily by Gong Su with some of the peppery local seed pods which Temeraire liked. No one suggested she should not be allowed to eat this time, and she devoured them so readily as to spray bits of meat around the feeding grounds, though ordinarily a rather delicate eater. Temeraire watched her enviously. Not only was he not allowed more than a taste of the posset itself, which he so enjoyed, but his belly was still inclined to be delicate after his excessive adventuring, so that Keynes had placed him on a strict and uninteresting diet of plain roasted meat, which his palate now disdained.
"Well, at least we have found the cure, then, surely."
Dulcia, having finished her repast, fell down asleep and began at once snoring loudly, with a thin, wheezing whine on the exhale. Nevertheless, an improvement, as she had only lately been perfectly unable to breathe save through her mouth. Keynes came over and sat down heavily on the log beside Lawrence, mopping his sweating red face with a kerchief, and said, disgruntled,
"Enough! Enough of this casting ourselves into alt! Have none of you learnt your lesson? The lungs are by no means clear!"
A heavy bank of clouds blew in during the night, so they all woke to a steady, dripping grey rain and clammy wet ground, the air still unpleasantly hot and clinging damply to the skin like sweat. Dulcia was worse again, drooping and tired after her previous day's cavorting, and the dragons were all of them more inclined to sneeze than ever. Even Temeraire sighed and shivered, trying to get more of the rain off his hide and out of the hollows of bone and muscle where it collected.
"I do miss China," he said, picking unhappily at his wet dinner.
Gong Su had been unable to sear the antelope carcass properly.
"It must be something else. We will find it, Lawrence,"
Catherine said, giving him his coffee cup at the breakfast table inside the castle. Lawrence accepted it mechanically and sat down among the rest of them. They ate silently, only the clatter of forks and plates. No one even offered around the salt cellar or asked for it. Chenery, ordinarily their life and gaiety, had bruised hollows under his eyes as if he had been beaten about the face, and Barclay had not come into breakfast at all. Keynes came in stamping his feet clear of mud, his coat sodden with rain and traces of whitish mucus, and said heavily,
"Very well.
We must have more of the thing. They looked at him, made uncomprehending by his tone, and he glared back ferociously before he admitted with reluctance, Maximus can breathe again, and sent them all running for the door. Keynes disliked greatly giving them even this much hope, and resisted all their demands for more. But they could stand by Maximus's head and hear for themselves the slow wheeze of air through his nostrils, and the same for Dulcia also. The two of them yet coughed and coughed and coughed, but the aviators all agreed amongst themselves that the tenor of the sound was entirely altered, a salutary and productive cough, and not the wet, terrible lung rattle which did not end, or so they contrived to persuade one another. Dorset still made his daily implacable notations, however, and the surgeons continued with the other experiments. A sort of custard made out of green bananas and coconut meat was offered to Lily, who tasted one swallow and refused any more point-blank. Masoria was persuaded to lie curled on one side, and a battery of candles were melted onto her skin, lit and cupped, to attempt and heat the lungs, with no apparent effect except to leave great streaks of wax upon her hide. A tiny, white-haired, coy matron appeared at their gates, dragging behind her a laundry tub nearly her own size, packed to the brim with a preparation made of monkey livers. With only her broken bits of pigeon Dutch, she managed to convey the impression she had brought them a sovereign remedy for any illness whatsoever. When tried on Immortalis, he ate one unenthusiastic bite and left the rest. But they still had to pay, as the remainder was quickly raided by Dulcia, who cleaned out the tub and looked for more. Her appetite increased by leaps and bounds as the sensation of taste returned, and she coughed less daily. By the end of the fifth day, almost not at all, except for an occasional hacking. Maximus coughed a while longer, but in the middle of the night, towards the end of the week, they were all woken by a terrible squealing, distant shrieks of terror and fire. In a panic, they burst out from the tents to discover Maximus attempting guiltily to sneak unnoticed back into the parade grounds, with as much success as was to be expected in this endeavour, and carrying in his already bloodied jaws a spare ox. This he hurriedly swallowed down almost entire on finding himself observed, and then pretended not to know what they were talking about, insisting he had only got up to stretch his legs and settle himself more comfortably. The track of his dragging tail, followed through dust spotted liberally with blood, led them to a nearby stable, now half collapsed, the paddock circled by the wreckage of a fence, and the owners apoplectic with rage and terror at the loss of their valuable team of oxen.
"It is just that the wind turned, and they smelled so very good,"
Maximus confessed finally, when confronted with the evidence.
"And it has been so long since I have had a nice fresh cow, with no cooking or spices. Why, you ridiculous lummox, as though we would not feed you whatever you liked!"
Barclay said, without any heat whatsoever, petting him extravagantly.
"You will have two of them tomorrow."
"And let us have no more damned excuses out of you for not eating during the day, when you will go wandering about at night like a rampaging lion to stuff your belly,"
Keynes added more peevishly, scruffy with his night's growth of beard and disgruntled. He had for once sought his bed at a reasonable hour after having sat up nearly every night the week observing the dragons.
"Why you did not think to tell anyone, I can scarcely understand."
"I did not like to wake Barclay. He has not been eating properly,"
Maximus said earnestly, at which accusation Barclay, who had indeed shed another 2 stone of weight since their arrival, nearly spluttered himself into a fit.